From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Saudi warplanes hit positions of pro-Saudi forces in South Yemen Monday by mistake, killing 12 people. The strike happened on the first day of what was supposed to be a humanitarian truce. Positions in Lahej province were targeted, where Saudi-supported forces have been trying to encircle Yemeni resistance fighters. The Saudis also pounded a number of residential areas in Yemen, as Press TV's Bardi Ohanadar reports.
Saudi Arabia's self-declared ceasefire in Yemen goes into effect. However, its aerial bombardment of the war-torn country continued unabated ahead of the pause. Saudi warplanes bombed a medical center in Mustaba town in the northwestern Hajja province, killing a medical worker there. The Barim district in Sada province was also hit by another strike, leaving two civilians dead and two others injured. Saudi jets also pounded a district in Hodeida province twice. Earlier, the Hamdan district in the capital Sana'a was attacked by Saudi jets, but it's not clear if the attacks caused casualties. Saudi jets also targeted several districts in Amran, Lahij, and Jaf provinces. Riyadh has already violated several ceasefires in Yemen. Saudi Arabia's onslaught has claimed nearly 4,900 lives since it started in late March.
The humanitarian consequences of the conflict in Yemen have been catastrophic. That, according to Johannes van der Klauw, the UN's humanitarian coordinator for that country, who said the conflict has destroyed the lives and livelihoods of the majority of Yemenis. Stephanie Kutrix reports from the United Nations.
Civilians are paying the heaviest price in Yemen, the UN humanitarian coordinator for the country said on Monday. Johannes van der Klauw described hearing numerous accounts of death, hunger, and utter desperation as mothers and fathers struggle to find safety, security, and care for their loved ones. He called the high number of civilians who have been killed or injured a shocking testament to the suffering faced by the civilian population. Mr. van der Klauw added that the humanitarian community's ability to reach those in need will only be possible if parties to the conflict provide rapid, safe, and unimpeded humanitarian access. Meanwhile, the UN Secretary General welcomed the announcement by the Saudi-led coalition of a unilateral 5-day renewable humanitarian pause scheduled to start at midnight on Monday. Ban Ki-moon urged the Houthis and all other parties to maintain this break in fighting for the sake of all the Yemeni people. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
The U.S. and Turkey have agreed on the outlines of what is being called a safe zone inside Syria along the Turkey-Syria border. The deal would involve a significantly increased scope and pace of the U.S.-led air war against the Islamic State in northern Syria and includes a plan to drive the Islamic State out of a 68-mile-long area west of the Euphrates River that reaches into the province of Aleppo, which would then come under the control of the U.S.-backed so-called Syrian opposition. If fully implemented, it would also bring American planes in regular close proximity to bases, aircraft, and air defenses operated by the Syrian government, directly benefiting the opposition forces that are fighting the Syrian government. Ankara is also seeking to impose a no-fly zone in northern Syria. On Saturday, the Turkish Prime Minister's office announced their military campaign would be not only against ISIS, but also against the PKK, whose forces in northern Iraq have been helping to curb the advance of ISIS fighters. Turkey is already targeting Kurdish PKK forces from the air. Ankara sent bombers on a mission for a second night on Sunday, targeting logistics positions, warehouses, barracks, and PKK bases in northern Iraq, which Ankara claimed were in retaliation for PKK attacks against its security forces and police last week. Turkey has called a NATO meeting to discuss its security concerns regarding both ISIS and PKK forces. Meanwhile, Washington, despite its having previously relied on the Kurdish fighting militia as a force on the ground, now supports Turkey's fight against the PKK. The Turkish airstrikes against the PKK came as a military vehicle was struck by a car bomb and roadside explosives on a highway near Diyarbakir overnight on Sunday. According to the Turkish army, Kurdish militants then opened fire, wounding 4 soldiers. 6 people were reportedly detained following the attack. According to Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoglu, Turkey does not currently intend to send ground troops into Syria to fight ISIS. Turkey's stated intent to fight ISIS was met with skepticism in Syria. Press TV's Alaa Ibrahim was in Damascus Monday and filed this report.
The Syrian government has expressed a great deal of skepticism regarding Turkey's involvement in the fight against ISIL. As we all know, the Syrian government has long accused the Turkish government of being involved in supporting ISIL and providing ISIL with the necessary logistics and sometimes necessary means to achieve what it has achieved in the past few years. Also taking into consideration that the Syrian government had an unannounced coordination with the Kurdish militias operating in northern Syria, whom the Turkish government considers to be equally dangerous as ISIL. And also these Kurdish militias have often accused Ankara of supporting ISIL and allowing ISIL access to several cities on the border between Syria and Turkey. In June, they accused Ankara of allowing ISIL access into the city of Kobani. That being said, we have to be very clear and say that the Syrian government did not issue any formal statement regarding this issue, which is a bit peculiar, sort of speak. We have also to remember that just a few weeks ago, the Syrian Minister of Foreign Affairs, Waleed Al-Malim, was in Moscow meeting the Russian President, Vladimir Putin, and at that time, Vladimir Putin spoke about a regional alliance against ISIL that gathers countries like Turkey and Saudi Arabia, whom we all know has been some of the most important supporters of ISIL, directly or indirectly. And he said that there could be a coalition between these countries, Saudi Arabia and Turkey, and the Syrian government. And at that time, the Syrian government called the achievement of such an alliance a true miracle if it happens, also voicing skepticism. So at this point, it's unclear what the Syrian official stand on the Turkish airstrikes is. It's unclear whether this is really a move that goes into the best interest of Damascus, or does it go against the best interest of Damascus? And finally, we should also say that it seems at this point the Turkish airstrikes did not affect ISIL as much as everyone expected, given the fact that Turkey has a great deal of intelligence on ISIL, its movement, its recruitment, and it is backlines, sort of speaking.
Cuba says it's not about to give up its political system despite restored diplomatic relations with the United States. That, according to the country's vice president, Jose Machado Ventura, during a large Rebellion Day rally in Santiago de Cuba this past weekend. Sunday marked the 62nd anniversary of the Day of the Rebellion that is widely regarded as the start of the Cuban Revolution. CCTV's Michael Voss was in Havana and filed this report.
This is the largest, most important event in Cuba's political calendar. July the 26th marks the first armed uprising by Fidel Castro against the U.S.-backed dictator Fulgencio Batista. The raid on the Moncada barracks in Santiago failed, but it catapulted Castro onto the national stage and sparked a rebellion which led to the eventual victory 5 years later. Now, this year's rally took place at the former Moncada barracks, the first such event since the United States and Cuba had restored diplomatic relations. President Raul Castro left the keynote speech to his number three, Machado Ventura, who is another aging revolutionary. He spoke about the need for a prosperous and sustainable socialism, and on U.S. relations, he said that a lot more needed to be done before they could have normal relations.
With the reestablishment of diplomatic relations between Cuba and the U.S., now begins a long and complex road towards normalization of bilateral relations, which includes, among other issues, the lifting of the trade embargo and the return of the U.S. naval base in Guantanamo.
This was very much a speech aimed at reassuring the old guard and the party faithful that détente didn't mean giving up on principles. In an earlier speech a couple of weeks ago to a Communist Party youth conference, he made reference to an offer by the U.S. company Google to install Wi-Fi internet infrastructure across the island at no cost. His response was they wouldn't accept because this was about penetrating the country for ideological conquest. The aim of imperialists, he said, was to use this to destroy the revolution. After more than 50 years of conflict, there's still an awful lot of mistrust to overcome.
Greece's former finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, said he was authorized by Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras to create a parallel payment system in the event that the country's banks were shut down by its European creditors. Responding to a report in the Greek newspaper Katimerini about a telephone call on July 16th, in which Varoufakis was alleged to have said that he had been given a green light in December by then-future Prime Minister Tsipras to prepare a plan for a parallel currency system, the former finance minister challenged parts of the article and confirmed others in a post at his website, which also featured a corroborative statement from fellow economist James K. Galbraith, who also worked on the project after the new government took office early this year. Varoufakis said the plan would have involved accessing the tax records of people and companies in the country, creating reserve currency accounts for them, and attaching the accounts to tax file numbers. The government would have given PIN numbers to holders of taxation numbers and created digital transfers into reserve accounts of the tax file numbers so that if the banks were shut down, he said, quote, as a result of the ECB's aggressive action to deny some breathing space to the country, closed quote, the plan, when implemented, would be a parallel payment system. Varoufakis said the plan was very well developed and that it could have made a very big difference, adding, quote, very soon we could have extended it using apps on smartphones and it could become a functioning parallel system. And of course, this would be euro-denominated, but at the drop of a hat could be converted to a new drachma, closed quote. But he said that as he did his study, he was shocked to find out that the taxation department, the General Secretariat of Public Revenues, was under full control of the troika of international creditors outside of the control of his finance ministry. For more on that, we spoke with Dr. Richard Wolff, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and visiting professor at the graduate program in international affairs of the New School University in New York. We spoke with Dr. Wolff via Skype from New York Monday.
Well, you know, it's the usual political gamesmanship here. It was pretty clear, at least to many of us along the way, since the election of Syriza in January, when they become the government, that the Germans leading the rest of Europe, and while we focus on the Germans because they're obviously in charge, the willingness of pretty much the rest of Europe, with vague and lame disavowals occasionally, they went along with Germany in the policy. However, in those 5 months, it was reasonable to believe that there was at least some chance that an accommodation with Greece would be reached. And by accommodation, I mean a combination of relieving some of their foreign debt, that is the debt of the Greek government, to what they call the institutions, the IMF, the European Central Bank, and the European Union. It was reasonable to believe that some deal would be worked out to relieve that debt, number one, and number two, to help Greece rebuild its economic viability as an economy, that is to give it the basis for building up its exports, for limiting its imports, for identifying and building new sources of economic strength. They already have some strength, but they could build more, etc.
You know, let me just say to that point, I spent a lot of time at the closing table in 40-some-odd years in the title insurance business, you know, negotiating. And one of the things you do when you go in to negotiate is try to figure out what's in the adverse party's interest. Because you can assume safely, usually, not always, but usually, that they're going to go towards their own self-interest. Now, we heard about this IMF report, and I assume that was happening everywhere else there, saying that they needed to do exactly that to make the debt sustainable. And yet, what ended up happening was, from the point of view of economic negotiations, irrational.
That's right. And when that happens, or at least when it looks to you or me that it's irrational, that's just a way of saying that whatever the reason is, we haven't figured it out yet. So since we look at certain reasons and they're not behaving accordingly, we say irrational until we can identify what the reasons are.
Better model, right?
Yeah. And so let me tell you what they are. But first, to finish the story, the Greek negotiators always knew from the beginning that there was, of course, a chance, even though they assumed the Europeans would probably come around to some sort of deal. They did assume, because they aren't stupid, particularly not Varoufakis and the people around him.
Right.
I know him personally. This is a very sophisticated, highly informed fellow, way a cut above the usual politician who becomes a finance minister. For them to be irritated with him is a joke. If anything, it would go the other way around.
Right.
Although Varoufakis is a nice person and isn't given to that. But in any case, they had to, as responsible political leaders, they always had to have a contingency plan or two or three. You know, the United States Defense Department, to use a blunt example, has contingency plans for how to invade every country on this planet.
Right.
Not because they plan to do that next week, but because in the event that political, military, and other kinds of shifts occur in the world, they need to have work in place that they can rely on to enable the president and the Congress to make decisions under time pressure, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So you have a contingency plan.
Right.
All that happened that Varoufakis did was to take over the finance ministry in the perfectly legitimate way that it was given to him, and to work with an American economist, a professor named James Galbraith, who teaches at the University of Texas in Austin.
Right. The son of John Kenneth Galbraith, by the way, not for nothing.
Yeah, the son of, that's right. But a well-known economist, you know, like me, I know these people personally because the circle of left-of-center economists in the United States tend to know who each other are, et cetera, et cetera.
More like so, a triangle.
Yeah, so Jim Galbraith and Yiannis Varoufakis, he called him in, perfectly reasonable thing to do, set up a little group, and went to work to produce a contingency plan. Now, the irony is the Europeans, who had, by the way, their own contingency plans of what they might do in the event that the Greeks went the other way, were consistent with that vote on the 5th of July and may have pulled out. And I don't want to scare anyone, but if I were able to do the kind of sleuthing that, I don't know, the NSA does, I'd be looking really closely at what the plans of the Greek army were in relationship to its own country. The Greek army has taken over the country in the past, not that long ago. What the Germans were prepared to do, they had contingency plans, too, for alternative outcomes. The irony is that when things fell apart in the Greek left, when the decision was made to accept the German demands because of the fear of what would happen when they literally ran out of currency because there would be no euros left to move the goods and services around Greece, then the cry went up, oh, you should have had a contingency plan. Well, you know, it was naive to assume that there hadn't been one, especially when it concerns currencies. And a final word, Don, about that. If you're going to move from one currency to another, something that has happened in many countries over the last 200-300 years, then everyone who's ever studied this knows it has to be prepared in secret and it has to be done literally overnight. And the reason for that is not complicated. If you know it's coming, then every individual who can and every business that can will take steps, especially if you know, as we would have known in this case, that the new currency will be worth a lot less than the old one, that you hoard the old currency preferably outside the country, so that, for example, if a new drachma had been introduced, you could immediately bring the euros home, convert them into many more drachmas than you would have any other way of obtaining, and therefore get an advantage in the new situation. Right. So if people believe that that's even possible, they start hoarding euros outside the country, which, by the way, is exactly what happened since Syriza won the election, and indeed in some cases even before that. So all that Varoufakis was doing by keeping it secret was doing what every other financial authority that has ever contemplated the need for a currency switch like this, moving from one to the other, has always done. And so it is. There's nothing conspiratorial, nothing strange, nothing treasonous. It's really political hype. And my assumption is, unless this is fueled by something else, that it will blow over shortly.
Yeah, the thing that was interesting to me about it was at Varoufakis' website, he laid out some of the procedural steps that they were attempting to undertake, including getting taxpayer IDs of people so that they could create accounts, basically. Like here, you would, if you were going to deal with something like that electronically, you know, to transfer the funds, you would, if you're the federal government IRS, you would use the Social Security numbers. And now you can identify the players and figure things out from there.
You could try to limit the amount of shenanigans by basically overnight or over a weekend when financial accounts are frozen from Friday night to Monday morning. Right. You basically replace everybody's euro account with a drachma account or whatever else you're doing, so that everybody, it kind of starts Monday morning off in this new system, and will need that new currency to pay their taxes, to buy their goods, to collect their credit card slips, and all the rest of it. And to minimize the chaos, there'll always be some fooling around, for sure. And you can be damn sure that many, many Greek people have already squirreled euros outside of Greece, or for that matter, inside of Greece, gambling, if you like, that whatever finally happens, either it'll stay with the euro, and they will have lost nothing, or there'll be a new currency which they can take their euros and convert into large numbers of, and so get a bit of an advantage.
Right. So the thing that struck me was when he, as the finance minister, looks at this method, he finds out essentially that his own IRS, for lack of a better term, but his own ministry that's responsible for collecting the taxes, is not under the control of the government, but under the control of the euro people.
Yeah, that's because the previous governments had already, in exchange for the two prior bailouts, just to remind everyone listening, when Greece announces that it cannot pay its debts, the way Ireland announced that its banks could not cover their debts, or that the Spanish government announced that its regional savings banks couldn't do it, or for that matter, when millions of American subprime mortgagees announced in 2008 that they couldn't sustain their mortgage payments, whenever that kind of thing happens, the banks who made the loans are in deep trouble. And what the banks in Europe did, who had lent to Greece, was to get out of their trouble by leaning on their politicians, above all Mrs. Merkel in Germany and Mr. Sarkozy, then the leader of France, to get them, which was successful, to lend money out of the European institutions rather than those banks. So they got the European Union, the IMF, and the European Central Bank to lend many, many hundreds of billions of dollars, well, a couple hundred billion dollars worth of euros to Greece on condition that Greece use the money to pay back their debts to the private banks. This was wonderful for the private banks and meant that Greece now owed money to this abstract idea of European institution. And in in this bailout, which, by the way, was publicly listed as Europe helping Greece, when the accurate way to describe it was European politicians led by Merkel and Sarkozy, who had lost enormous popularity in their countries by having bailed out the banks the first time in 2008, got out of having to do it a second time in 2010, killing their political futures, by having the European institutions lend money to Greece to pay back the banks so that they wouldn't have to bail out the banks. It was a classic political hustle covered over as if Europe, and some whatever that is, was helping the country of Greece. Nothing of the sort happened, but to play the theater out that way, they imposed austerity on Greece and all kinds of rules and limitations. And yes, Mr. Varoufakis discovered that among those was a kind of control exercised from Brussels, the European Union's center, over the software governing Greek banks.
It's such a frightening thought to think that sovereignty over something so basic can just be contracted away.
You know, but you'd see, for example, if you look at the receivership into which the city of Detroit was placed by the state of Michigan, you will see that all kinds of activities of city government in Detroit that at least nominally you would think was under the democratic control of city institutions that are responsible to city elected officials, all of that was side. That's what receivership is. It's sideswiped, it's sidestepped, and the takeover authority, in the case of Detroit, it's the state of Michigan, begins to have that kind of control, and that's what the European Union officials in Brussels did to the Greek Central Bank, etc. My guess is that they knew what the conversations were, and that Varoufakis has signaled that he never really persuaded, if indeed he tried, but he never persuaded Tsipras, as well as a whole bunch of others, that this contingency plan should be put into action. And so it sat there like contingency plans often do. That's why you call them a contingency plan.
Right.
That is available if and when the political authorities make the determination. I think the fear that Greece, outside of the European Union, would be even more negatively impacted by having the access to the euro closed, by not being within the tariff union that the European Union represents, that this would put them in a position a little bit like Turkey, which, if you're Greek, has all kinds of meanings that you don't even want to think about, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That the political authorities inside Syriza and Greece weren't prepared to make that move. And my guess is that Merkel knew that there was the contingency. It had been, by the way, discussed ever since January. People talked about a Greek exit, and they knew that if Greece exited, there would have to be a currency substitute. And they knew that it was unlikely that a finance ministry wouldn't have explored, at least. I mean, to pretend that, oh, we're not going to do that, and therefore we'll never do a contingency plan, that would make no sense to a European politician anyway. And so when I heard, gee, they hadn't made a plan, I said to myself, okay, it's possible, but it's unlikely.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.